Clipper Audio presents an unabridged recording of Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel, narrated by Simon Slater. This work is copyrighted 2009 by Hilary Mantel. This recording is copyrighted 2009 by W.F. Howes Limited. Hilary Mantel's Man Booker Prize-winning novel is set in England in the 1520s. Henry VIII is on the throne, but has no heir. Cardinal Wolsey is his chief adviser, charged with securing the divorce the Pope refuses to grant. Into this atmosphere of distrust and need comes Thomas Cromwell, first as Wolsey's clerk, and later his successor. The author begins with the following quotation from Vitruvius' De Architectura on the Theatre, 27 BC.
There are three kinds of scenes, one called the tragic, second the comic, third the satiric. Their decorations are different and unlike each other in scheme. Tragic scenes are delineated with columns, pediments, statues, and other objects suited to kings. Comic scenes exhibit private dwellings with balconies and views representing rows of windows, after the manner of ordinary dwellings. Satiric scenes are decorated with trees, caverns, mountains, and other rustic objects delineated in landscape style.
And with the following from John Skelton's Magnificence and Interlude, 1520.
These be the names of the players: Felicity, Liberty, Measure, Magnificence, Fancy, Counterfeit Countenance, Crafty Conveyance, Cloaked Collusion, Courtly Abusion, Folly, Adversity, Poverty, Despair, Mischief, Good Hope, Redress, Circumspection, Perseverance.
And now, Wolf Hall.
Part 1. Chapter 1. Across the Narrow Sea. Putney, 1500. So now get up! Felled, dazed, silent, he has fallen. Knocked full length on the cobbles of the yard, his head turned sideways, his eyes are turned towards the gate, as if someone might arrive to help him out. One blow, properly placed, could kill him now. Blood from the gash on his head, which was his father's first effort, is trickling across his face. Add to this, his left eye is blinded. But if he squints sideways, with his right eye he can see that the stitching of his father's boot is unravelling. The twine has sprung clear of the leather, and a hard knot in it has caught his eyebrow and opened another cut. So now get up! Walter is roaring down at him, working out where to kick him next. He lifts his head an inch or two and moves forward on his belly, trying to do it without exposing his hands, on which Walter enjoys stamping. What are you, an eel? His parent asks. He trots backwards, gathers pace, and aims another kick. It knocks the last breath out of him. He thinks it may be his last. His forehead returns to the ground. He lies waiting for Walter to jump on him. The dog, Bella, is barking, shut away in an outhouse. I'll miss my dog, he thinks. The yard smells of beer and blood. Someone is shouting down on the riverbank. Nothing hurts, or perhaps it's that everything hurts, because there is no separate pain that he can pick out. But the cold strikes him just in one place, just through the cheekbone as it rests on the cobbles. Look now, Walter bellows. He hops on one foot as if he's dancing. Look what I've done, burst my boot, kicking your head. Inch by inch forward. Never mind if he calls you an eel or a worm or a snake. Head down, don't provoke him. His nose is clotted with blood, and he has to open his mouth to breathe. his father's momentary distraction at the loss of his good boot allows him the leisure to vomit. "That's right," Walter yells. "Spew everywhere!" "Spew everywhere on my good cobbles." "Come on, boy, get up! Let's see you get up! By the blood of Creeping Christ, stand on your feet!" "Creeping Christ," he thinks. "What does he mean?" His head turns sideways. His hair rests on his own vomit. The dog barks, Walter roars, and bells peal out across the water. He feels a sensation of movement, as if the filthy ground has become the Thames. It gives and sways beneath him. He lets out his breath, one great final gasp. "You've done it this time," a voice tells Walter. But he closes his ears, or God closes them for him. He's pulled downstream on a deep black tide. The next thing he knows, it's almost noon, and he's propped in the doorway of Pegasus, the flying horse. His sister Cat is coming from the kitchen with a rack of hot pies in her hands. When she sees him, she almost drops them. Her mouth opens in astonishment. "Look at you!" "Cat, don't shout, it hurts me." She bawls for her husband. "Morgan Williams!" She rotates on the spot, eyes wild, face flushed from the oven's heat. "Take this tray. Body of God, where are you all?" He's shivering from head to foot, exactly like Bella did when she fell off the boat that time. A girl runs in. "The master's gone to town." "I know that fool." The sight of her brother had panicked the knowledge out of her. She thrusts the tray at the girl. "If you leave them where the cats can get at them, I'll box your ears till you see stars." Her hands empty, she clasps them for a moment in violent prayer. "Fighting again? Or was it your father?" "Yes," he says, vigorously nodding, making his nose drop gouts of blood. "Yes," he indicates himself, as if to say, "Walter was here." Cat calls for a basin, for water in a basin, for a cloth, for the devil to rise up right now and take away Walter, his servant. "Sit down before you fall down." He tries to explain that he's just got up, out of the yard. It could be an hour ago, could even be a day, and for all he knows, today might be tomorrow. Except that if he had lain there for a day, surely either Walter would have come and killed him for being in the way, or his wounds would have clotted a bit, and by now he would be hurting all over and almost too stiff to move. From deep experience of Walter's fists and boots, he knows that the second day can be worse than the first. "Sit. Don't talk," Cat says. When the basin comes, she stands over him and works away, dabbing at his closed eye, working in small circles round and round at his hairline. Her breathing is ragged, and her free hand rests on his shoulder. She swears under her breath. Sometimes she cries and rubs the back of his neck, whispering, "There, hush there," as if it were he who were crying, though he isn't. He feels as if he's floating, and she's weighting him to earth. He would like to put his arms around her and his face in her apron and rest there, listening to her heartbeat. But he doesn't want to mess her up, get blood all down the front of her. When Morgan Williams comes in, he's wearing his good town coat. He looks Welsh and pugnacious. It's clear he's heard the news. He stands by Cat, staring down, temporarily out of words, till he says, "See?" He makes a fist and jerks it three times in the air. "That," he says, "that's what he'd get. Walter, that's what he'd get from me." "Just stand back," Cat advises. "You don't want bits of Thomas on your London jacket." No more does he. He backs off.
"I wouldn't care, but look at you, boy. You could cripple the brute in a fair fight."
"It never is a fair fight," Cat says. "He comes up behind you, right, Thomas, with something in his hand."
"Looks like a glass bottle in this case," Morgan Williams says. "Was it a bottle?"
He shakes his head. His nose bleeds again. "Don't do that, brother," Cat says. It's all over her hand. She wipes the blood clots down herself. What a mess on her apron. He might as well have put his head there after all.
I don't suppose you saw, Morgan says, what he was wheeled in, exactly.
That's the value, says Cat, of an approach from behind. You sorry lost to the magistrate's bench. Listen, Morgan, shall I tell you about my father? He'll pick up whatever's to hand, which is sometimes a bottle, true. I've seen him do it to my mother, even our little Bet. I've seen him hit her over the head. Also, I've not seen him do it, which was worse, and that was because it was me about to be felled.
I wonder what I've married into, Morgan Williams says.
But really, this is just something Morgan says. Some men have a habitual sniffle, some women have a headache, and Morgan has this wonder. The boy doesn't listen to him. He thinks, if my father did that to my mother, so long dead, then maybe he killed her. No, surely, he'd have been taken up for it. Putney's lawless, but you don't get away with murder. Cat's what he's got for a mother, crying for him, rubbing the back of his neck. He shuts his eyes to make the left eye equal with the right. He tries to open both. Cat, he says,
I have got an eye under there, have I? Because I can't see anything.
Yes, 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 she says, while Morgan Williams continues his interrogation of the facts, settles on a hard, moderately heavy, sharp object, but possibly not a broken bottle, otherwise Thomas would have seen its jagged edge, prior to Walter splitting his eyebrow open and aiming to blind him. He hears Morgan forming up this theory, and would like to speak about the boot, the knot in the twine, but the effort of moving his mouth seems disproportionate to the reward. By and large, he agrees with Morgan's conclusion. He tries to shrug, but it hurts so much, and he feels so crushed and disjointed that he wonders if his neck is broken. Anyway, Cat says, what were you doing, Tom, to set him off? He usually won't start up till after dark, if it's for no cause at all.
Yes, Morgan Williams says. Was there a cause?
Yesterday, I was fighting.
You were fighting yesterday? Who in the holy name were you fighting?
I don't know.
The name, along with the reason, has dropped out of his head. But it feels as if, in exiting, it has removed a jagged splinter of bone from his skull. He touches his scalp carefully. Bottle? Possible. Oh, Cat says. They're always fighting, boys, down by the river.
So let me be sure I have this right, Morgan says. He comes home yesterday with his clothes torn and his knuckles skinned, and the old man says, what's this, been fighting? He waits a day, then hits him with a bottle. Then he knocks him down in the yard, kicks him all over, beats up and down his length with a plank of wood that comes to hand.
Did he do that?
It's all over the parish. They were lining up on the wharf to tell me. They were shouting at me before the boat tied up. Morgan Williams, listen now. Your wife's father's beaten Thomas and he's crawled dying to his sister's house. They've called the priest. Did you call the priest?
Oh, you Williamses, Cat says. You think you're such big people around here? People are lining up to tell you things? But why is that? It's because you believe anything.
But it's right, Morgan yells. As good as right, eh? If you leave out the priest, and that he's not dead yet.
You'll make that magistrate's bench for sure, Cat says, with your close study of the difference between a corpse and my brother.
When I'm a magistrate, I'll have your father in the stocks. Fine him? You can't fine him enough. What's the point of fining a person who will only go and rob or swindle money to the same value out of some innocent who crosses his path?
He moans, tries to do it without intruding. There, 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 Cat whispers.
I'd say the magistrates have had their belly full, Morgan says. If he's not watering his ale, he's running illegal beasts on the common. If he's not despoiling the common, he's assaulting an officer of the peace. If he's not drunk, he's dead drunk. And if he's not dead before his time, there's no justice in this world.
Finished? Cat says. She turns back to him. Tom, you'd better stay with us now. Morgan Williams, what do you say? He'll be good to do the heavy work when he's healed up. He can do the figures for you. He can add and... what's the other thing? All right, don't laugh at me. How much time do you think I had for learning figures with a father like that? If I can write my name, it's because Tom here taught me. He won't, he says, like it. He can only manage like this. Short, simple, declarative sentences.
Like? He should be ashamed, Morgan says.
Cat says, shame was left out when God made my dad. He says,
because just a mile away. He can easily. Come after you, just let him.
Morgan demonstrates his fist again, his little nervy Welsh punch. After Cat had finished swabbing him and Morgan Williams had ceased boasting and reconstructing the assault, he lay up for an hour or two to recover from it. During this time, Walter came to the door with some of his acquaintance, and there was a certain amount of shouting and kicking of doors, though it came to him in a muffled way, and he thought he might have dreamt it. The question in his mind now is, what am I going to do? I can't stay in Putney. Partly this is because his memory is coming back. For the day before yesterday and the earlier fight, and he thinks there might have been a knife in it somewhere. And whoever it was stuck in, it wasn't him, so was it by him? All this is unclear in his mind. What is clear is his thought about Walter. I've had enough of this. If he gets after me again, I'm going to kill him. And if I kill him, they'll hang me. And if they're going to hang me, I want a better reason. Below, the rise and fall of their voices. He can't pick out every word. Morgan says he's burnt his boats. Cat is repenting of her first offer. A poster's potboy, general factotum and chucker out. Because, Morgan's saying,
Walter will always be coming round here, won't he? And, where's Tom? Send him home. Who paid the bloody priest to teach him to read and write? I did. And you're reaping the bloody benefit now, you leek-eating cunt.
He comes downstairs. Morgan says cheerily,
you're looking well, considering.
The truth is about Morgan Williams, and he doesn't like him any the less for it. The truth is, this idea he has that one day he'll beat up his father-in-law is solely in his mind. In fact, he's frightened of Walter, like a good many people in Putney, and for that matter, Mortlake and Wimbledon. He says, I'm on my way then. Cat says, you have to stay tonight. You know the second day is the worst. Who's he going to hit when I'm gone? Not our affair, Cat says. Betty's married and got out of it, thank God.
Morgan Williams says, if Walter was my father, I tell you, I'd take to the road.
He waits.
As it happens, we've gathered some ready money.
A pause. I'll pay you back. Morgan says, laughing, relieved.
And how will you do that, Tom?
He doesn't know. Breathing is difficult, but that doesn't mean anything. It's only because of the clotting inside his nose. It doesn't seem to be broken. He touches it, speculatively. And Cat says, careful, this is a clean apron. She's smiling a pained smile. She doesn't want him to go. And yet she's not going to contradict Morgan Williams, is she? The Williamses are big people, in Putney and in Wimbledon. Morgan dotes on her. He reminds her she's got girls to do the baking and mind the brewing. Why doesn't she sit upstairs sewing like a lady and praying for his success when he goes off to London to do a few deals in his town coat? Twice a day she could sweep through the Pegasus in a good dress and set in order anything that's wrong. That's his idea. And though as far as he can see she works as hard as ever she did when she was a child, he can see how she might like it, that Morgan would exhort her to sit down and be a lady. I'll pay you back, he says. I might go and be a soldier. I could send you a fraction of my pay and I might get loot. Morgan says,
but there isn't a war.
There'll be one somewhere, Cat says. Or I could be a ship's boy, but, you know, Bella, do you think I should go back for her? She was screaming. He had her shut up.
So she wouldn't nip his toes, Morgan says.
He's satirical about Bella. I'd like her to come away with me.
I've heard of a ship's cart, not of a ship's dog.
She's very small.
She'll not pass for a cart, Morgan laughs. Anyway, you're too big all round for a ship's boy. They have to run up the rigging like little monkeys. Have you ever seen a monkey, Tom? Soldiers more like it. Be honest, like father, like son. You weren't last in line when God gave out fists.
Right, Cat said. Shall we see if we understand this? One day my brother Tom goes out fighting. As punishment, his father creeps up behind and hits him with a whatever, but heavy and probably sharp, and then, when he falls down, almost takes out his eye, exerts himself to kick him in his ribs, beats him with a plank of wood that stands ready to hand, knocks in his face, so that if I were not his own sister, I'd barely recognise him. And my husband says, the answer to this, Thomas, is go for a soldier. Go and find somebody you don't know, take out his eye and kick in his ribs, actually kill him, I suppose, and get paid for it.
May as well, Morgan says, as go fighting by the river without profit to anybody. Look at him. If it were up to me, I'd have a war just to employ him.
Morgan takes out his purse. He puts down coins, chink, 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 with enticing slowness. He touches his cheekbone. It is bruised, intact, but so cold. Listen, Cat says. We grew up here. There's probably people that would help Tom out. Morgan gives her a look, which says eloquently, do you mean there are a lot of people who would like to be on the wrong side of Walter Cromwell? Have him breaking their doors down? And she says, as if hearing his thought out loud, no, maybe. Maybe, Tom, it would be for the best, do you think? He stands up. She says, Morgan, look at him. He shouldn't go tonight. I should. An hour from now he'll have had a skinful and he'll be back. He'd set the place on fire if he thought I were in it. Morgan says, have you got what you need for the road? He wants to turn to Cat and say, no. But she's turned her face away and she's crying. She's not crying for him, because nobody, he thinks, will ever cry for him. God didn't cut him out that way. She's crying for her idea of what life would be like. Sunday after church, all the sisters, sisters-in-law, wives kissing and patting, swatting at each other's children, and at the same time loving them and rubbing their little round heads, women comparing and swapping babies, and all the men gathering and talking business, wool, yarn, lengths, shipping, bloody Flemings, fishing rights, brewing, annual turnover, nice timely information, favour for favour, little sweeteners, little retainers, my attorney says. That's what it should be like, married to Morgan Williams, with the Williamses being a big family in Putney. But somehow it's not been like that. Walter has spoiled it all. Carefully, stiffly, he straightens up. Every part of him hurts now. Not as badly as it will hurt tomorrow. On the third day, the bruises come out, and you have to start answering people's questions about why you've got them. By then, he will be far from here, and presumably no one will hold him to account, because no one will know him or care. They'll think it's usual for him to have his face beaten in. He picks up the money. He says,
Hoyle Morgan Williams, diolch am yr arian.
Thank you for the money.
Gwfalch am Catherine. Gwfalch am eich busnes. Weli chi eto choibryd. Pob y lwc.
Look after my sister. Look after your business. See you again sometime. Morgan Williams stares. He almost grins. Would do if it wouldn't split his face open. All those days he'd spent hanging around the Williams' households. Did they think he'd just come for his dinner?
Pobre luck,
Morgan says slowly. Good luck. He says, if I follow the river, is that as good as anything?
Where are you trying to get?
To the sea. For a moment Morgan Williams looks sorry it has come to this. He says,
you'll be all right, Tom, I tell you. If Bella comes looking for you, I won't send her home hungry. Cat will give her a pie.
He has to make the money last. He could work his way down river, but he's afraid that if he's seen, Walter will catch him through his contacts and his friends, those kind of men who will do anything for a drink. What he thinks of first is slipping onto one of the smugglers' ships that go out of Barking, Tilbury. But then he thinks, France is where they have wars. A few people he talks to strangers very easily, are of the same belief. Dover, then. He gets on the road. If you help load a cart, you get a ride in it, as often as not. It gives him to think how bad people are at loading carts. Men trying to walk straight ahead through a narrow gateway with a wide wooden chest. A simple rotation of the object solves a great many problems. And then horses. He's always been around horses, frightened horses too, because when in the morning Walter wasn't sleeping off the effects of the strong brew he kept for himself and his friends, he would turn to his second trade, farrier and blacksmith. And whether it was his sour breath, or his loud voice, or his general way of going on, even horses that were good to shoe would start to shake their heads and back away from the heat. Their hooves gripped in Walter's hands, they'd tremble. It was his job to hold their heads and talk to them, rubbing the velvet space between their ears, telling them how their mothers love them, and talk about them still, and how Walter will soon be over. He doesn't eat for a day or so. It hurts too much. But by the time he reaches Dover, the big gash on his scalp has closed, and the tender parts inside, he trusts, have mended themselves. Kidneys, lungs, and heart. He knows by the way people look at him that his face is still bruised. Morgan Williams had done an inventory of him before he left. Teeth, miraculously still in his head, and two eyes, miraculously seeing, two arms, two legs. What more do you want? He walks around the dock, saying to people, "Do you know where there's a war just now?" Each man he asks stares at his face, steps back and says, "You tell me." They are so pleased with this, they laugh at their own wit so much that he continues asking just to give people pleasure. Surprisingly, he finds he will leave Dover richer than he arrived. He'd watched a man doing the three-card trick, and when he learned it, he set up for himself. Because he's a boy, people stop to have a go. It's their loss. He adds up what he's got and what he's spent. Deduct a small sum for a brief grapple with a lady of the night. Not the sort of thing you could do in Putney, Wimbledon or Mortlake, or not without the Williams family getting to know and talking about you in Welsh. He sees three elderly lowlanders struggling with their bundles and moves to help them. The packages are soft and bulky, samples of woolen cloth. A port officer gives them trouble about their documents, shouting into their faces. He lounges behind the clerk, pretending to be a lowland oaf, and tells the merchants by holding up his fingers what he thinks a fair bribe. "Please," says one of them in effortful English to the clerk, "will you take care of these English coins for me? I find them surplus." Suddenly the clerk is all smiles. The lowlanders are all smiles. They would have paid much more. When they board, they say, "The boy is with us." As they wait to cast off, they ask him his age. He says 18, but they laugh and say, "Child, you are never." He offers them 15, and they confer and decide that 15 will do. They think he's younger, but they don't want to shame him. They ask what's happened to his face. There are several things he could say, but he selects the truth. He doesn't want them to think he's some failed robber. They discuss it among themselves, and the one who can translate turns to him. "We are saying the English are cruel to their children and cold-hearted. The child must stand if his father comes in the room. Always the child should say very correctly, 'My father, sir, and madam, my mother.'" He is surprised. Are there people in the world who are not cruel to their children? For the first time, the weight in his chest shifts a little. He thinks there could be other places better. He talks. He tells them about Bella, and they look sorry. And they don't say anything stupid like, "You can get another dog." He tells them about the Pegasus, and about his father's brew house, and how Walter gets fined for bad beer at least twice a year. He tells them about how he gets fines for stealing wood, cutting down other people's trees, and about the too many sheep he runs on the common. They are interested in that. They show the woolen samples and discuss amongst themselves the weight and the weave, turning to him from time to time to include and instruct him. They don't think much of English finished cloth generally, though these samples can make them change their mind. He loses the thread of the conversation when they try to tell him their reasons for going to Calais, and different people they know there. He tells them about his father's blacksmith business, and the English speaker says, interested, "Can you make a horseshoe?" He mimes to them what it's like, hot metal and a bad-tempered father in a small space. They laugh. They like to see him telling a story. "Good talker," one of them says. Before they dock, the most silent of them will stand up and make an oddly formal speech, at which one will nod, and which the other will translate. "We are three brothers. This is our street. If ever you visit our town, there is a bed and hearth and food for you." "Goodbye," he will say to them. "Goodbye and good luck with your lives."
"Hoil, clothmen. Guvalch eich business."
He is not stopping till he gets to a war. The weather is cold, but the sea is flat. Cat has given him a holy medal to wear. He's slung it around his neck with a cord. It makes a chill against the skin of his throat. He unloops it. He touches it with his lips for luck. He drops it. It whispers into the water. He will remember his first sight of the open sea, a grey, wrinkled vastness, like the residue of a dream. Chapter 2. Paternity, 1527. So, Stephen Gardiner, going out as he's coming in. It's wet and for a night in April unseasonably warm, but Gardiner wears furs, which look like oily and dense black feathers. He stands now, ruffling them, gathering his clothes about his tall, straight person like black angel's wings.
"Late,"
Master Stephen says unpleasantly. He is bland.
"Me or your good self?"
"You," he waits.
"Drunked on the river. The boatmen say it's the eve of one of their patron saints."
"Did you offer a prayer to her?"
"I'll pray to anyone, Stephen, till I'm on dry land."
"I'm surprised you didn't take an oar yourself. You must have done some river work when you were a boy." Stephen sings always on one note. Your reprobate father, your low birth. Stephen is supposedly some sort of semi-royal by blow, brought up for payment, discreetly as their own, by discreet people in a small town. They are wool trade people, whom Master Stephen resents and wishes to forget. And since he himself knows everybody in the wool trade, he knows too much about his past for Stephen's comfort, the poor orphan boy. Master Stephen resents everything about his own situation. He resents that he's the king's unacknowledged cousin. He resents that he was put into the church, though the church has done well by him. He resents the fact that someone else has late-night talks with the cardinal, to whom he is confidential secretary. He resents the fact that he's one of those tall men who are hollow-chested, not much weight behind him. He resents his knowledge that if they met on a dark night, Master Thomas Cromwell would be the one who walked away dusting off his hands and smiling. "God bless you," Gardiner says, passing into the night unseasonably warm. Cromwell says, "Thanks." The cardinal, writing, says without looking up,
"Thomas, still raining? I expected you earlier."
Boatman, river, saint. He's been travelling since early morning, and in the saddle for the best part of 2 weeks on the cardinal's business, and has now come down by stages, and not easy stages, from Yorkshire. He's been to his clerk's at Gray's Inn and borrowed a change of linen. He's been east to the city to hear what ships have come in and to check the whereabouts of an off-the-books consignment he's expecting. But he hasn't eaten and hasn't been home yet. The cardinal rises. He opens a door, speaks to his hovering servants.
"Cherries? What, no cherries? April, you say? Only April? We shall have sore work to placate my guest, then."
He sighs.
"Bring what you have, but it will never do, you know. Why am I so ill-served?"
Then the whole room is in motion. Food, wine, fire built up. A man takes his wet outer garments with a solicitous murmur. All the cardinal's household servants are like this, comfortable, soft-footed, and kept permanently apologetic and teased. And all the cardinal's visitors are treated in the same way. If you had interrupted him every night for 10 years and sat sulking and scowling at him on each occasion, you would still be his honoured guest. The servants effaced themselves, melting away towards the door.
What else would you like? The cardinal says.
The sun to come out.
So late? You tax my powers.
Dawn would do.
The cardinal inclines his head to the servants.
I shall see to this request myself, he says gravely,
and gravely they murmur and withdraw. The cardinal joins his hands. He makes a great, deep, smiling sigh, like a leopard settling in a warm spot. He regards his man of business. His man of business regards him. The cardinal, at 55, is still as handsome as he was in his prime. Tonight he is dressed not in his everyday scarlet, but in blackish purple and fine white lace, like a humble bishop. His height impresses. His belly, which should in justice belong to a more sedentary man, is merely another princely aspect of his being, and on it, confidingly, he often rests a large white beringed hand, a large head, surely designed by God to support the papal tiara, is carried superbly on broad shoulders, shoulders upon which rest, though not at this moment, the great chain of Lord Chancellor of England. The head inclines. The cardinal says in those honeyed tones famous from here to Vienna,
"So now, tell me, how was Yorkshire?"
"Filthy," he sits down. "Weather, people, manners, morals."
"Well, I suppose this is the place to complain, though I am already speaking to God about the weather."
"Oh, and the food. 5 miles inland and no fresh fish."
"And scant hope of a lemon, I suppose. What do they eat?"
"Londoners, when they can get them. You've never seen such heathens. They're so high, low foreheads, live in caves, yet they pass for gentry in those parts."
He ought to go and look for himself, the cardinal. He is Archbishop of York, but has never visited his see.
"And as for your grace's business..."
"I am listening," the cardinal says. "Indeed, I go further. I am captivated."
As he listens, the cardinal's face creases into its affable, perpetually attentive folds. From time to time he notes down a figure that he has given. He sips from a glass of his very good wine, and at length he says,
"Thomas, what have you done, monstrous servant? An abbess is with child? 2, 3 abbesses? Or let me see, have you set fire to Whitby on a whim?"
In the case of his man Cromwell, the cardinal has 2 jokes, which sometimes unite to form 1. The first is that he walks in demanding cherries in April and lettuce in December. The other is that he goes about the countryside committing outrages and charging them to the cardinal's accounts. And the cardinal has other jokes from time to time, as he requires them. It is about 10 o'clock. The flames of the wax candles bow civilly to the cardinal and stand straight again. The rain, it has been raining since last September, splashes against the glass window.
"In Yorkshire," he says, "your project is disliked."
The cardinal's project. Having obtained the Pope's permission, he means to amalgamate some 30 small, ill-run monastic foundations with larger ones, and to divert the income of these foundations, decayed but often very ancient, into revenue for the 2 colleges he's founding, Cardinal College at Oxford and a college in his hometown of Ipswich, where he is well remembered as the scholar son of a prosperous and pious master butcher, a guild man, a man who also kept a large and well-regulated inn of the type used by the best travellers. The difficulty is... No, in fact, there are several difficulties. The cardinal, a bachelor of arts at 15, a bachelor of theology by his mid-20s, is learned in the law, but does not like its delays. He cannot quite accept that real property cannot be changed into money with the same speed and ease with which he changes a wafer into the body of Christ. When he once, as a test, explained to the cardinal just a minor point of the land law concerning, well, never mind, it was a minor point, he saw the cardinal break into a sweat and say, "Thomas, what can I give you to persuade you never to mention this to me again?"
"Find a way, just do it," he would say,
when obstacles were raised,
and when he heard of some small person obstructing his grand design, he would say, "Thomas, give them some money to make them go away."
He has the leisure to think about this, because the cardinal is staring down at his desk, at the letter he has half written. He looks up.
"Tom?"
And then,
"No, never mind. Tell me why you are scowling in that way."
"The people up there say they're going to kill me."
"Really?"
the cardinal says. His face says, "I am astonished and disappointed."
"And will they kill you? Or what do you think?"
Behind the cardinal is a tapestry, hanging the length of the wall. King Solomon, his hands stretched into darkness, is greeting the Queen of Sheba.
"I think if you're going to kill a man, do it. Don't write him a letter about it. Don't bluster and threaten and put him on his guard."
"If you ever plan to be off your guard, let me know. It is something I should like to see. Do you know who... But I suppose they don't sign their letters. I shall not give up my project. I have personally and carefully selected these institutions, and His Holiness has approved them under seal. Those who object misunderstand my intention. No one is proposing to put old monks out on the roads."
This is true. There can be relocation. There can be pensions, compensation. It can be negotiated with goodwill on both sides. Bow to the inevitable, he urges. Deference to the Lord Cardinal. Regard his watchful and fatherly care. Believe his keen eye is fixed on the ultimate good of the Church. These are the phrases with which to negotiate. Poverty, chastity, and obedience. These are what you stress when you tell some senile prior what to do.
"They don't misunderstand," he says. "They just want the proceeds themselves.
You will have to take an armed guard when next you go north."
The cardinal, who thinks upon a Christian's last end, has had his tomb designed already by a sculptor from Florence. His corpse will lie beneath the outspread wings of angels in a sarcophagus of porphyry. The veined stone will be his monument when his own veins are drained by the embalmer, when his limbs are set like marble. An inscription of his virtues will be picked out in gold. But the colleges are to be his breathing monument, working and living long after he is gone. Poor boys, poor scholars, carrying into the world the cardinal's wit, his sense of wonder and of beauty, his instinct for decorum and pleasure, his finesse. No wonder he shakes his head. You don't generally have to give an armed guard to a lawyer. The cardinal hates any show of force. He thinks it unsubtle. Sometimes one of his people, Stephen Gardiner, let's say, will come to him denouncing some nest of heretics in the city. He will say earnestly, "Poor benighted souls, you pray for them, Stephen, and I'll pray for them, and we'll see if between us we can't bring them to a better state of mind, and tell them, mend their manners, or Thomas More will get hold of them and shut them in his cellar. And all we will hear is the sound of screaming."
"Now, Thomas,"
he looks up,
"do you have any Spanish?"
"A little. Military, you know, rough."
"You took service in the Spanish armies, I thought."
"French."
"Ah, indeed. And no fraternizing?"
"Not past the point. I can insult people in Castilian."
"I shall bear that in mind," the cardinal says. "Your time may come. For now, I was thinking that it would be good to have more friends in the Queen's household."
Spies, he means. To see how she will take the news. To see what Queen Catalina will say in private and unleashed, when she has slipped the noose of the diplomatic Latin, in which it will be broken to her that the King, after they have spent some 20 years together, would like to marry another lady. Any lady. Any well-connected princess whom he thinks might give him a son. The cardinal's chin rests on his hand. With finger and thumb he rubs his eyes.
"The King called me this morning," he says. "Exceptionally early."
"What did he want?"
"Pity. And at such an hour. I heard a dawn mass with him, and he talked all through it. I love the King. God knows how I love him. But sometimes my faculty of commiseration is strained."
He raises his glass, looks over the rim.
Picture to yourself, Tom. Imagine this. You are a man of some 35 years of age. You are in good health and of a hearty appetite. You have your bowels opened every day. Your joints are supple. Your bones support you. And in addition, you are King of England. But...
He shakes his head.
But if only he wanted something simple. The Philosopher's Stone, the elixir of youth. One of those chests that occur in stories full of gold pieces.
And when you take some out, it just fills up again?
Exactly. Now, the chest of gold I have hopes of, and the elixir all the rest, but where shall I begin looking for a son to rule his country after him?
Behind the cardinal, moving a little in the draught, King Solomon bows, his face obscured. The Queen of Sheba, smiling, light-footed, reminds him of the young widow he lodged with when he lived in Antwerp. Since they had shared a bed, should he have married her? In honour, yes. But if he had married Anselma, he couldn't have married Liz. And his children would be different children from the ones he has now.
If you cannot find him a son, he says, you must find him a piece of scripture to ease his mind.
The cardinal appears to be looking for it on his desk.
Well, Deuteronomy, which positively recommends that a man should marry his deceased brother's wife, as he did.
The cardinal sighs.
But he doesn't like Deuteronomy.
Useless to say why not. Useless to suggest that if Deuteronomy orders you to marry your brother's relict, and Leviticus says don't, or you will not breed, you should try to live with the contradiction, and accept that the question of which takes priority was thrashed out in Rome for a fat fee by leading prelates 20 years ago, when the dispensations were issued and delivered under papal seal.
I don't see why he takes Leviticus to heart. He has a daughter living.
But I think it is generally understood in the scriptures that children mean sons.
The cardinal justifies the text, referring to the Hebrew. His voice is mild, lulling. He loves to instruct, where there is the will to be instructed. They have known each other some years now, and though the cardinal is very grand, formality has faded between them.
I have a son, he says. You know that, of course. God forgive me. A weakness of the flesh.
The cardinal's son, Thomas Winter, they call him, seems inclined to scholarship and a quiet life, though his father may have other ideas. The cardinal has a daughter too, a young girl, whom no one has seen. Rather pointedly, he's called her Dorothea, the gift of God. She's already placed in a convent, where she will pray for her parents.
And you have a son, the cardinal says. Or should I say, you have one son you give your name to, but I suspect there are some you don't know running around on the banks of the Thames.
I hope not. I wasn't 15 when I ran away.
It amuses Wolsey that he doesn't know his age. The cardinal peers down through the layers of society to a stratum well below his own as the butcher's beef-fed son, to a place where his servant is born on a day unknown in deep obscurity. His father was no doubt drunk at his birth. His mother, understandably, was preoccupied. Cat has assigned him a date. He is grateful for it.
Well, 15, the cardinal says. But at 15, I suppose you could do it. I know I could. Now I have a son. Your boatman on the river has a son. Your beggar on the street has a son. Your would-be murderers in Yorkshire no doubt have sons who will be sworn to pursue you in the next generation. And you yourself, as we have agreed, have spawned a whole tribe of riverine brawlers. But the king alone has no son. Whose fault is that?
God's.
Nearer than God?
The queen.
More responsible for everything than the queen?
He can't help a broad smile. Yourself, your grace.
Myself, my grace. What am I going to do about it? I tell you what I might do. I might send Master Stephen to Rome to sound out the courier. But then I need him here.
Wolsey looks at his expression and laughs. Squabbling underlings. He knows quite well that, dissatisfied with their original parentage, they are fighting to be his favourite son.
Whatever you think of Master Stephen, he is well grounded in canon law, and a very persuasive fellow, except when he tries to persuade you. I will tell you...
He breaks off. He leans forward. He puts his great lion's head in his hands, the head that would indeed have worn the papal tiara, if at the last election the right money had been paid out to the right people.
I have begged him, the cardinal says. Thomas, I sank to my knees, and from that humble posture I tried to dissuade him. Majesty, I said, be guided by me. Nothing will ensue, if you wish to be rid of your wife, but a great deal of trouble and expense.
And he said...
He held up a finger, in warning. Never, he said, call that dear lady my wife, until you can show me why she is, and how it can be so. Till then, call her my sister, my dear sister. Since she was quite certainly my brother's wife, before going through a form of marriage with me.
You will never draw from Wolsey a word that is disloyal to the king.
What it is, he says, it's...
He hesitates over the word.
It's, in my opinion, preposterous. Though my opinion, of course, does not go out of this room. Oh, don't doubt it. There were those at the time who raised their eyebrows over the dispensation, and year by year there were persons who would murmur in the king's ear. He didn't listen, though now I must believe that he heard. But you know the king was the most uxorious of men. Any doubts were quashed.
He places a hand softly and firmly down on his desk.
They were quashed and quashed.
But there is no doubt of what Henry wants now. An annulment. A declaration that his marriage never existed.
For 18 years, the cardinal says, he has been under a mistake. He has told his confessor that he has 18 years' worth of sin to expiate.
He waits for some gratifying small reaction. His servant simply looks back at him, taking it for granted that the seal of the confessional is broken at the cardinal's convenience.
So if you send Master Stephen to Rome, he says, it will give the king's whim, if I may.
The cardinal nods. You may so term it.
An international airing.
Master Stephen may go discreetly, as it were, for a private papal blessing.
You don't understand, Rome.
Wolsey can't contradict him. He has never felt the chill at the nape of the neck that makes you look over your shoulder when, passing from the Tiber's golden light, you move into some great block of shadow. By some fallen column, by some chaste ruin, the thieves of integrity wait, some bishop's whore, some nephew of a nephew, some moneyed seducer with furred breath. He feels sometimes fortunate to have escaped that city with his soul intact.
Put simply, he says, the Pope's spies will guess what Stephen's about while he's still packing his vestments, and the cardinals and the secretaries will have time to fix their prices. If you must send him, give him a great deal of ready money. Those cardinals don't take promises. What they really like is a bag of gold to placate their bankers, because they mostly run out of credit.
He shrugs.
I know this.
I should send you, the cardinal says jolly. You could offer Pope Clement a loan.
Why not? He knows the money markets. It could probably be arranged. If he were Clement, he would borrow heavily this year to hire in troops to ring his territories. It's probably too late. For the summer season's fighting, you need to be recruiting by Candlemas. He says,
will you not start the king's suit within your own jurisdiction? Make him take the first steps. Then he will see if he really wants what he says he wants.
That is my intention. What I mean to do is to convene a small court here in London. We will approach him in a shocked fashion. King Harry, you appear to have lived all these years in an unlawful manner, with a woman not your wife. He hates, saving his majesty, to appear in the wrong. which is where we must put him very firmly. Possibly he will forget that the original scruples were his. Possibly he will shout at us and hasten in a fit of indignation back to the Queen. If not, then I must have the dispensation revoked here or in Rome, and if I succeed in parting him from Catherine, I shall marry him smartly to a French princess.
No need to ask if the Cardinal has any particular princess in mind. He has not one, but two or three. He never lives in a single reality, but in a shifting, shadow mesh of diplomatic possibilities. While he's doing his best to keep the King married to Queen Catherine and her Spanish imperial family, by begging Henry to forget his scruples, he will also plan for an alternative world in which the King's scruples must be heeded and the marriage to Catherine is void. Once that nullity is recognised and the last 18 years of sin and suffering wiped from the page, he will readjust the balance of Europe, allying England with France, forming a power block to oppose the young Emperor Charles, Catherine's nephew. And all outcomes are likely. All outcomes can be managed, even massaged into desirability. Prayer and pressure, pressure and prayer. Everything that comes to pass will pass by God's design, a design re-envisaged and redrawn with helpful emendations by the Cardinal. He used to say, "The King will do such and such." Then he began to say, "We will do such and such." Now he says, "This is what I will do." "But what will happen to the Queen?" he asks. "If he casts her off, where will she go? Convents can be comfortable. Perhaps she will go home to Spain." "No, I think not. It is another country now. It is, what, 27 years since she landed in England?" The Cardinal sighs. "Oh, I remember her, at her coming in. Her ships, as you know, had been delayed by the weather, and she had been day upon day tossed in the channel. The old King rode down the country, determined to meet her. She was then at Dogmer's Field, at the Bishop of Bath's palace, and making slow progress towards London. It was November, and yes, it was raining. At his arriving, her household stood upon their Spanish manners. The princess must remain veiled until her husband sees her on her wedding day. But you know the old King." He did not, of course. He was born on or about the date the old King, a renegade and refugee all his life, fought his way to an unlikely throne. Wolsey talks as if he himself had witnessed everything. I witnessed it. And in a sense he has, for the recent past arranges itself only in the patterns acknowledged by his superior mind, and agreeable to his eye. He smiles. "The old King, in his later years, the least thing could arouse his suspicion. He made some show of reining back to confer with his escort, and then he leapt, he was still a lean man, from the saddle, and told the Spanish to their faces, he would see her or else. 'My land and my laws,' he said, 'we'll have no veils here. Why may I not see her? Have I been cheated? Is she deformed? Is it that you are proposing to marry my son Arthur to a monster?'" Thomas thinks. He was being unnecessarily Welsh. "Meanwhile, her women had put the little creature into bed, or said they had, for they thought that in bed she would be safe against him, not a bit. King Henry strode through the rooms, looking as if he had in mind to tear back the bedclothes. The women bundled her into some decency. He burst into the chamber. At the sight of her, he forgot his Latin. He stammered and backed out like a tongue-tied boy." The Cardinal chuckled. "And then, when she first danced at court, our poor Prince Arthur sat smiling on the dais, but the little girl could hardly sit still in her chair. No one knew the Spanish dancers, so she took to the floor with one of her ladies. I will never forget that turn of her head, the moment when her beautiful red hair slid over one shoulder. There was no man who saw it who didn't imagine, though the dance was in fact very sedate. Ah, dear, she was 16. The Cardinal looks into space, and Thomas says, "God forgive you."
God forgive us all. The old king was constantly taking his lust to confession. Prince Arthur died, then soon after the queen died, and when the old king found himself a widower, he thought he might marry Catherine himself, but then... He lifts his princely shoulders. They couldn't agree over the dowry, you know. The old fox Ferdinand, her father. He would fox you out of any payment due. But our present majesty was a boy of 10 when he danced at his brother's wedding, and in my belief, it was there and then that he set his heart on the bride. They sit and think for a bit. It's sad, they both know it's sad. The old king freezing her out, keeping her in the kingdom and keeping her poor, unwilling to miss the part of the dowry he said was still owing, and equally unwilling to pay her widow's portion and let her go. But then it's interesting, too, the extensive diplomatic contacts the little girl picked up during those years, the expertise in playing off one interest against another. When Henry married her, he was 18, guileless. His father was no sooner dead than he claimed Catherine for his own. She was older than he was, and years of anxiety had sobered her and taken something from her looks. But the real woman was less vivid than the vision in his mind. He was greedy for what his older brother had owned. He felt again the little tremor of her hand, as she had rested it on his arm when he was a boy of 10. It was as if she had trusted him, as if, he told his intimates, she had recognised that she was never meant to be Arthur's wife, except in name. Her body was reserved for him, the second son, upon whom she turned her beautiful blue-grey eyes, her compliant smile. "She always loved me," the king would say. 7 years or so of diplomacy, if you can call it that, kept me from her side, but now I need fear no one. Rome has dispensed. The papers are in order. The alliances are set in place. I have married a virgin, since my poor brother did not touch her. I have married an alliance. Her Spanish relatives. But, above all, I have married for love. And now, gone, or as good as gone. Half a lifetime waiting to be expunged, eased from the record. Ah, well, the cardinal says, what will be the outcome? The king expects his own way, but she will be hard to move. There is another story about Catherine, a different story. Henry went to France to have a little war. He left Catherine as regent. Down came the Scots. They were well beaten, and at Flodden, the head of their king cut off. It was Catherine, that pink and white angel, who proposed to send the head in a bag by the first crossing to cheer up her husband in his camp. They dissuaded her, told her it was, as a gesture, un-English. She sent instead a letter, and with it the surcoat in which the Scottish king had died, which was stiffened, black and crackling with his pumped-out blood. The fire dies, an ashy log subsiding. The cardinal, wrapped in his dreams, rises from his chair and personally kicks it. He stands looking down, twisting the rings on his fingers, lost in thought. He shakes himself and says, "Long day. Go home. Don't dream of Yorkshiremen." Thomas Cromwell is now a little over 40 years old. He's a man of strong build, not tall. Various expressions are available to his face, and one is readable, an expression of stifled amusement. His hair is dark, heavy and waving, and his small eyes, which are a very strong sight, light up in conversation. So the Spanish ambassador will tell us quite soon. It is said he knows by heart the entire New Testament in Latin, and so, as a servant of the cardinal, is apt, ready with a text, if abbots flounder. His speech is low and rapid, his manner assured. He is at home in courtroom or waterfront, bishop's palace or inn yard. He can draft a contract, train a falcon, draw a map, stop a street fight, furnish a house and fix a jury. He will quote you a nice point in the old authors, from Plato to Plautus and back again. He knows new poetry and can say it in Italian.
He works all hours, first up and last to bed. He makes money, and he spends it. He will take a bet on anything. He rises to leave, says,
"If you did have a word with God and the sun came out, then the king could ride out with his gentlemen, and if he were not so fretted and confined, then his spirits would rise and he might not be thinking about Leviticus, and your life would be easier."
"You only partly understand him. He enjoys theology, almost as much as he enjoys riding out." He is at the door. Wolsey says,
"By the way, the talk at court. His Grace the Duke of Norfolk is complaining that I have raised an evil spirit and directed it to follow him about. If anyone mentions it to you, just deny it."
He stands in the doorway, smiling slowly. The Cardinal smiles too, as if to say, "I have saved the good wine to last. Don't I know how to make you happy?" Then the Cardinal drops his head over his papers. He is a man who, in England's service, scarcely needs to sleep. 4 hours will refresh him, and he will be up when Westminster's bells have rung in another wet, smoky, lightless April day.
"Good night," he says. "God bless you, Tom."
Outside, his people are waiting with lights to take him home. He has a house in Stepney, but tonight he's going to his town house. A hand on his arm, Rafe Sadler, a slight young man with pale eyes.
"How was Yorkshire?"
Rafe's smile flickers. The wind pulls the torch flame into a rainy blur.
"I haven't to speak of it. The Cardinal fears it will give us bad dreams."
Rafe frowns. In all his 21 years, he's never had bad dreams. Sleeping securely under the Cromwell roof since he was 7. First at Fenchurch Street, and now at the Austin Friars. He's grown up with a tidy mind, and his nighttime worries are all rational ones. Thieves, loose dogs, sudden holes in the road.
"The Duke of Norfolk," he says, then, "No, never mind. Who's been asking for me while I've been away?"
The damp streets are deserted. The mist is creeping from the river. The stars are stifled in damp and cloud. Over the city lies the sweet, rotting odour of yesterday's unrecollected sins. Norfolk kneels, teeth chattering, beside his bed. The Cardinal's late-night pen scratches like a rat beneath his mattress. While Rafe, by his side, gives him a digest of the office news, he formulates his denial for whom it may concern. "His Grace the Cardinal wholly rejects any imputation that he has sent an evil spirit to wait upon the Duke of Norfolk. He deprecates the suggestion in the strongest possible terms. No headless calf, no fallen angel in the shape of loll-tongued dog, no crawling, pre-used winding sheet, no Lazarus nor animated cadaver has been sent by His Grace to pursue His Grace, nor is any such pursuit pending." Someone is screaming down by the quays. The boatmen are singing. There is a faint, faraway splashing. Perhaps they're drowning someone.
"My Lord Cardinal makes the statement without prejudice to his right to harass and distress my Lord of Norfolk by means of any phantasma which he may in his wisdom elect, at any future date, and without notice given, subject only to the Lord Cardinal's views in the matter."
This weather makes old scars ache. But he walks into his house, as if it were midday, smiling, and imagining the trembling Duke. It is 1 o'clock. Norfolk, in his mind, is still kneeling. A black-faced imp with a trident is pricking his calloused heels.
This ends Disc 1.